on The Voice.
This is VOA News. I'm Marissa Melton. Panic spread through Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, on Thursday as dozens of angry police officers took to the streets to protest the killing of their fellow officers by armed gangs. Protesters first attacked Prime Minister Ariel Henry's residence. VOA Creole's reporter at the residence heard multiple gunshots but could not determine whether anyone was wounded or killed. The protesters later headed to the airport where Henry was arriving after a trip to Argentina to attend a summit of a community of Latin American and Caribbean states. VOA's reporter said the protesters entered the airport, confronted the prime minister before his security detail took him to safety. The protesters burned tires at the National Police headquarters and flew the Haitian flag at half-staff in honor of their fallen comrades. Violence between Israelis and Palestinians has flared up again in the West Bank, leaving nearly a dozen people dead. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Israeli forces conducted a raid at the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, killing a number of Palestinians, some described as militants, but one was a 61-year-old woman. This was the deadliest incident there in two decades, and Israeli forces are on heightened alert as Palestinians prepare to bury the dead and fill the streets in protest. Two rockets were then fired from Gaza, the first such attack since Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's return to power. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The Biden administration has moved to protect the pristine Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in northeastern Minnesota from future mining. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland signed an order Thursday closing over 350 square miles of the Superior National Forest to mineral leasing for 20 years. From Washington, this is VOA News. The U.S. economy continues to grow but slowed down in the last quarter. AP correspondent Jennifer King has more.
The Commerce Department estimates that the nation's gross domestic product decelerated last quarter, growing at an annual pace of 2.9% from October to December. That's slowing from 3.2% in the fall. For the year, the GDP expanded slightly over 2%, much slower than the blistering growth in 2021, with an economy recovering from the pandemic. The numbers were boosted by resilient spending by consumers, businesses, and the government. Most analysts think the economy will slow further in the current quarter and slide into at least a mild recession by mid-year. An intended consequence of the Federal Reserve's aggressive series of interest rate hikes meant to crush the worst inflation in four decades. Jennifer King, Washington.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on Thursday lauded the Ford Motor Company's 100-year history of assembling vehicles in South Africa and underscored Washington's resolve to expand trade ties with countries that it can count on, including South Africa.
We know that a thriving Africa is in the interest of the United States. A thriving Africa means a larger market for our goods and services. It means more investment opportunities for our businesses.
Yellen spoke after touring Ford's plant in Silverton, a suburb of Pretoria. It's the third leg of her three-country trip across the African continent that is aimed at expanding U.S. economic ties and countering China's influence on the continent. Yellen said the plant, which employs 4,000 people, is an example of how deeper ties between the United States and Africa could produce good jobs and boost economic growth for both sides. U.S. Special Operations Forces have killed a senior Islamic State group official and 10 other terrorist operatives in remote northern Somalia. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the operation in a mountainous cave complex targeted Bilal al-Sudani, a key financial facilitator for the global terrorist organization. President Biden was briefed last week about the proposed mission, which has been months in the planning. Pentagon officials say no civilians were injured or killed in the operation. And authorities say the 72-year-old gunman who sprayed bullets into a Southern California ballroom dance hall, killing 11 people, had no known connection with the victims. Investigators are still trying to determine a motive for the shooting. And President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden hosted a Lunar New Year celebration at the White House on Thursday evening, even as Americans mourn that mass shooting in the state of California that included Asian American victims and perpetrators. From Washington, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Today is Friday, January 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Junaid Rafoi in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russia pounds Kyiv with missiles as Ukraine pushes for quick delivery of Western tanks.
A morning rush hour assault killed at least one person in Kyiv and left critical infrastructure damaged in the Black Sea region of Odessa, according to officials.
African heads of state meet in Senegal to discuss ways to increase food production.
The consensus throughout the three-day event has been that it's time for Africa to end its dependence on food imports. The continent has enough arable land to feed 9 billion people.
And soaring tensions in the occupied West Bank after an Israeli raid kills 9 Palestinians. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukraine State Emergency Services says Russia pounded Ukraine with missiles on Thursday, killing a total of 11 people and seriously damaging energy infrastructure in the Black Sea region of Odessa. In the capital, Kyiv, at least one person was killed, and locals were forced to seek cover in metro stations. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
A morning rush hour assault killed at least one person in Kyiv and left critical infrastructure damaged in the Black Sea region of Odessa, according to officials. A spokesperson for Ukraine's state emergency service said a total of 11 people had been killed during the Russian strikes throughout the course of the day. Kyiv region resident Valentina says her home was destroyed in the attack.
I got out of the house walking over glass splinters. Then I pulled glass splinters out of one foot. I got high blood pressure and medical workers gave me an injection. I don't know. I don't remember how I got out of the house. Everything was in rubble.
Back in the capital, people sought cover in the metro station during a nationwide air alert. Explosions could be heard overhead. The missile strikes followed a drone attack overnight and came a day after Ukraine secured pledges of modern battle tanks from Germany and the United States to beef up its troops. It's a move that's infuriated Russian officials. Moscow has, in the past, responded to apparent Ukrainian successes with massed airstrikes. An Air Force spokesperson said as many as 6 warplanes had taken off from an Arctic region in northern Russia and launched long-range missiles. At one point, Kyiv authorities said all the incoming missiles had been shot down by air defences, but warned that the threat had not passed. Minutes later, loud explosions rocked 2 districts of Kyiv. Impacts were also reported elsewhere in the Kyiv region, damaging infrastructure and homes. The latest attack on the city is one of more than a dozen airstrikes Russia has unleashed on the power grid since October, which have caused sweeping outages during winter. Ukraine's largest private energy producer, DTEC, said it was conducting emergency power shutdowns because of the danger of missile attacks. Other power producers said they were following suit.
That's Lauren Anthony of Reuters, and top Chinese, Russian and American officials are scrambling this month to visit nations in Africa, the world's fastest growing continent. Several U.S. officials are in Africa, walking a fine line between their desire for Africa's support against Russian aggression and Chinese ambitions, and their promise to work that benefits the continent. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Washington.
Top Chinese, Russian, and American officials have in past weeks flocked to Africa in what they say is a quest to build deeper partnerships. President Joe Biden said last month that he, too, plans to visit this year. Washington says this is not about countering Russian and Chinese ambitions, but about building meaningful relationships in areas such as business, health, and peace and security. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Our partnership in Africa is not about about other nations. Our partnership there, it's as demonstrated by our commitments at the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, the United States sees African countries as genuine partners and wants to build relationship based on mutual respect.
But the continent's top diplomat says Africa, which was brutally colonized by European powers for centuries, is no one's pawn. And he added, China understands that. Moussafaki Mohamed is chairman of the African Union Commission.
Africa refuses to be seen as an arena for influence struggles. We are open to cooperation and partnership with everyone, as long as they respect our principles, our priorities, and our interests. The partnership we have with China is built on these principles.
But as the most senior visiting U.S. official said recently, these great power rivals are keenly aware of one another's activities, especially as China and Russia flex their muscles globally. Janet Yellen is U.S. Treasury Secretary.
Many African countries are now plagued by high and unsustainable debt, and that's undeniably a problem, and much of it is related to Chinese investments in Africa. So I think that's simply a factual statement. But this is not for us. This is not a competition with China. We want to deepen our engagement with Africa.
Analysts say these two goals, real partnership but also great power competition, are not mutually exclusive. Cameron Hudson is a consultant on Africa with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
All of these things can be true at the same time. However, we're not acknowledging that truth. We are acknowledging only one truth, which is that we want to see Africa develop. And I think it's just more complicated than that.
Analysts estimate that China has spent more than $1 trillion on its global Belt and Road Initiative, which builds infrastructure in the developing world. China maintains a strict stance of non-interference in other countries' internal affairs. During his first trip on the job, China's new foreign minister rejected the notion of Africa as an ideological battleground, as it often was during the Cold War. Chinese Foreign Minister Qin Yang.
No country, no people have the right to force African countries and its people to take sides. Africa should be a platform for international cooperation, not an arena for competition between major countries.
The next top American official to visit in coming days will be Biden's ambassador to the United Nations, who previously oversaw the continent at the State Department. And then, presumably, Biden goes. The White House this week said there were no concrete plans to announce yet. Biden has framed the conflict in Ukraine as a struggle between democracies and autocracies. With Africa showing clear signs of democratic backsliding, Hudson wonders whether Biden will keep those ideals in front on African soil.
Or will he kind of ignore that or put that on a back burner so that he can build relationships that might advantage Washington at the UN or down the road politically?
So will the president pack principle or practicality or both when he makes the trip? Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Anita. African heads of state and development partners will discuss ways to increase Africa's agricultural production at a summit in progress in Senegal. Climate change, soaring inflation, and the effects of Russia's war in Ukraine have combined to make food security precarious throughout much of Africa. Annika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
The consensus throughout the three-day event has been that it's time for Africa to end its dependence on food imports. The continent has enough arable land to feed 9 billion people, yet it spends $75 billion each year to import more than 100 million metric tons of food, according to the African Development Bank. Akinwumi Adesina is the president of the bank, which organized the summit. Only a secure continent can develop with pride, he said, for there is no pride in begging for food. The timing is right, and the moment is now, he says. My heart and my determination is that Africa feeds itself. Around 282 million Africans suffer from hunger, according to UN figures, and persistent drought has pushed some areas, such as the Horn of Africa and Madagascar, to the brink of famine. Recent disruptions in the global food supply chain have also aggravated the issue. Africa typically imports 30 million metric tons of food from the now warring nations of Russia and Ukraine, and energy, fertilizer, and food prices have increased by 40% to 300%, according to the African Development Bank. Muhammadu Buhari is the president of Nigeria. In order to become self-sufficient, he said, African nations must increase funding toward agricultural initiatives and rural infrastructure. To succeed, there is no doubt that we need to subsidize farmers, he says. We must reduce the rate of rural to urban migration through the development of rural areas. He says we must invest heavily in irrigation to help address the increasing frequency of droughts. Due to high lending risks, less than 3% of total financing from African commercial banks goes towards funding agriculture, Buhari said, and central banks must pick up the slack. At a CEO roundtable Thursday, Ahmed Abdelatif, president of Sudanese business conglomerate CTC Group, said risks can be minimized with agri-insurance.
If you're one of the unlucky...
He says, if you're one of the unlucky 0.5% where the rain does not come, it wipes you out totally, and you're in very big trouble. So agri-insurance would be a big enabler. Various speakers pointed to success stories on the continent. Ethiopia increased production of a heat-resistant wheat variety from 5,000 to 800,000 hectares over a four-year period, and is now on its way to becoming a wheat exporter. The adoption of a drought-resistant maize variety in Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda has more than doubled outputs. In response to the conflict in Ukraine, Zimbabwe began producing its own fertilizer and wheat. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa said the country expects to produce enough wheat to begin exports next year. He says, a country must be ruled by the people of that country. A country must be developed by the people of that country. And a country must eat what it sows. That is village wisdom, he says. The conference will continue through Friday. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
A new UNESCO Global Education Monitoring Report released on International Day of Education Tuesday shows that barely one in three countries are on track to reach their SDG 4 targets on pre-primary education and upper secondary completion. Manos Antoninis, director of UNESCO's GEM Reports, tells VOA's Leonard Modu that the 2023 SDG 4 Scorecard Progress Report is meant to help countries draw policy recommendations to meet their goals towards the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development.
What the Global Education Monitoring Report and the UNESCO Institute for Statistics have done is to help countries fulfill a commitment they took in 2015 to set national targets. And that's quite special because the targets that we tend to set are global, and it is not very clear what every country can do. We asked countries to specify from the point where they are now where they aim to be in 2025 and in 2030 for seven indicators that are very broad and very important for every country in the world.
If you were to bring up some of the key findings, what stood out to you?
You can find countries that are doing very well in terms of getting all five-year-olds to school or ensuring that all young people complete secondary education. So that's a very important thing. The second interesting thing is we find how countries, when they set targets, whether they are doing that well. And for some indicators where there is a lot of experience, we have data, we know how countries progress, countries themselves know where they are, they set realistic but ambitious targets. But there are some other indicators which are becoming increasingly important, like those on learning. Whether children learn after 6 years of school or after 9 years of school, where many countries still lack the data. And there you see that what happens often is that the poorer countries set very ambitious targets because they don't know where exactly they are and they don't quite know how fast they can progress. And the rich countries do the opposite. They tend to lowball, as they say, put targets that are relatively unambitious because they have a bit more information, but they try to exaggerate because they don't want to be caught out not doing well enough. In general, for a number of indicators, we only find one in three countries having good enough prospect of achieving their target or their benchmark, as we call it, by 2025. And that is, of course, an alarm call, either for improving the target they have, making it more achievable, or accelerating, finding ways and policies to improve their education status.
The scorecard shows that two in three low-income countries do not meet either of the two minimum benchmarks on education finance.
There are two indicators, is how much of their income countries spend on education and how much of their budget they spend on education. Poor countries tend not to spend a lot of their income because they don't raise enough taxes to be able to then spend. That constrains their opportunity, and that's why sometimes external assistance is needed. But African countries, if they are committed to education, they spend a large part of their budget because they have many more children and they need to deliver the services to them. The problem arises, we said, with those that fail both benchmarks. One of the objectives, the accountability objective of this scorecard, to remind governments that they're actually lagging behind, and they have peers who have managed to overcome this. They have managed to commit, they have managed to find the solutions to both raise more revenues and to allocate it to education. So that's what we hope to achieve by bringing more visibility to these benchmarks.
That's Manos Antoninis, director of the Global Education Monitoring GEM Report, speaking to VOA's Leonard Modu from Paris, France. Israeli military says two rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip and intercepted. The rocket launch early Friday came amid soaring tensions after an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank that killed 9 Palestinians, including at least 7 militants and a 61-year-old woman. It was the first Gaza rocket attack since Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu returned to power at the head of a far-right government that has pledged a tough line against Palestinian militants. In the past, Israel has launched airstrikes on Gaza shortly after any rocket fire. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Junaid Rufo in Washington. Turkey's Constitutional Court on Thursday rejected a call by the second largest opposition party, the HDP, to postpone a decision to shut down the party until after the Turkish general elections, now set for May. Critics say the decision adds to concerns that President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is using the judiciary to undermine the opposition ahead of the poll. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
In a blaze of color and music, the pro-Kurdish HDP launched its campaign with a coalition of left parties. But these were not easy times for Turkey's second-largest opposition party. The Constitutional Court has frozen its state funding as the court considers a case to close down the HDP for alleged links to Kurdish rebels fighting the Turkish state. HDP denies the claims. The court Thursday rejected a call to delay the case until after parliamentary and presidential elections, now scheduled for May 14th. The former HDP leader, Selahattin Demirtas, is already in jail in a case condemned by the European Court of Human Rights as politically motivated. The government rejects such charges, saying its courts are independent. The HDP is the main rival to Erdogan's AKP party in vying for the country's large Kurdish vote in what is expected to be a closely fought campaign. The main opposition, CHP party, is also facing legal woes. Its charismatic mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, widely tipped as a presidential challenger, last month was convicted of insulting an official and now faces a political ban. Rights groups warn the judiciary is increasingly becoming a political tool. With Turkey grappling with rampant inflation, opinion polls indicate Erdogan, for the first time in 2 decades, faces a serious electoral challenge. But the fear is the courts, rather than voters, could decide the outcome. Since 1950, Turkey has had free and fair elections, but parties this year are calling for electoral safeguards to be a priority, as polls suggest it may be the closest election in decades. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Nigerian authorities have hailed the launch of a deep-water seaport in Lagos. They say that will create 300,000 jobs and reduce shipping bottlenecks. While the new port is expected to reduce losses due to congestion, shipping industry experts say Nigeria's poor roads and rail connections to ports also must be improved. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
The launch by President Muhammadu Buhari during his 2-day visit this week to Lagos signaled his government's effort to grow Nigeria's economy through infrastructural development. The $1.5 billion Chinese-built Lekki Deep Sea Port sits on 90 hectares of land in the Lagos Free Trade Zone, the biggest port by size in West Africa. Authorities say ships docking at the port could be up to 4 times the size of vessels at the state's Tincan and Apapa ports. They expect it will ease delays and congestion at ports and increase earnings by up to $360 billion in coming years. Ifeoita Ephraim is a manager at Ports and Terminal Nigeria Limited.
The current ports we have in the country are sited or located along rivers, tributaries, and that's why there are limitations. It's a welcome development, you know, to have an infrastructure of this nature in our country. With these, larger vessels will be able to berth at our ports, and we shall be in competition with our neighboring countries such as Cotonou here.
Most of Nigeria's seaports were built many decades ago and are either closed or operating below capacity. Nigeria loses an estimated $1 billion a year to delays and bottlenecks at ports. To address the problem, the Nigerian Ports Authority launched an automated process for clearing cargo at ports. Abiodun Badamosi is the former general manager of Nigeria's Western Ports. He says the new deep seaport at Lagos will add to Nigeria's economic progress and create jobs. The country's Bureau of Statistics says Nigeria's unemployment rate is 33%. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week. The U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, is the second cabinet member to visit Africa in an attempt to strengthen partnerships with former U.N. Security Council members. This and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Since this past September, health professionals in the U.S. and elsewhere noted surges in the levels of respiratory syncytial virus disease, influenza, and COVID-19. There was concern that the spread of these three diseases could spark what some have called a tridemic. Hi, I'm Rick Pantaleo. Join my guest and me for the science edition of Press Conference USA when we talk about these respiratory illnesses. Listen Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Wishing you a wonderful weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Joe Biden met with Japanese Prime Minister Kishida Fumio in Washington this month to discuss the future of U.S.-Japan relations. In a joint statement, the two leaders reaffirmed their commitment to the United States and Japan's unprecedented cooperation based on the two countries' common goals and priorities. As President Biden stated,
"These shared democratic values are the source of our strength, source of our alliance, and the source of our being able to deliver for all our people."
In addition to bolstering defenses against growing challenges in the Indo-Pacific region, the joint statement discussed plans to strengthen both nations' capabilities to meet a host of new and emerging threats. The United States and Japan signed a Space Cooperation Framework Agreement. Its goal is furthering scientific progress and human space exploration, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a statement. "Together, we have advanced the frontiers of human endeavor and scientific knowledge through our partnership, from the creation of the International Space Station to development of the Lunar Gateway, a research outpost that will orbit the moon and be used to prepare for future missions to Mars." The United States and Japan also plan to improve their economic security by building resilience and supply chains to protect from threats such as economic coercion, non-market policies and practices, and natural disasters. In addition, because Japan and the United States are the two largest democratic economies in the world, the joint statement promised to build the global economy to achieve gender equity and equality, make sustainable progress to net zero emissions, and improve creditor coordination to provide debt relief. The United States sees Japan as one of its closest allies, newly committed to achieving peace and prosperity, not only through our words, but through our actions. The times demand no less.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.